So we kick off now the Gospel of Luke. It is a long book. I mentioned to you, it's the longest book in the New Testament, and if you include it with Acts, it actually takes up 25% of the New Testament. Luke also wrote Acts. So I wasn't 100% sure, how do I teach this big Gospel of Luke? A lot of pastors will take a year, even 2 years, to teach through it completely. So I can't do my traditional verse by verse, chapter by chapter. We'd be here for a long time. On top of that, I've already taught Matthew and John and Mark, and so we don't want to hit all the same stories. We want to pick different stories. And so I thought a lot this week, well, how am I going to do that? Let's first pick out the things that are unique to the Gospel of Luke. And I'm super excited. The prodigal son is one of the unique parables to the Gospel of Luke, which is my favorite. And I've waited to teach that for 4 years. So I'm super excited about that one. But these past 2 weeks, I spent reading through the entire Gospel of Luke. And I couldn't help but notice one thing that stood out. That throughout the entire Gospel, Jesus spends so much time eating and drinking. And if he's not eating and drinking, then the story is he's going to a meal, or the story is he's coming from a meal, or he's referencing food or drink in a parable, or he's multiplying food to feed the masses. It is apparent to me from Luke's gospel that food and meals matter. Now, I married my high school sweetheart, Karen, who's here tonight, and we've been together, married almost 23 years. We've been 28 years together as of 2020, but it almost didn't happen because of a meal. Now, our dates have changed over the years since our first date. This week, we had a date night on Tuesday, super fancy and exciting. We went to Target for our date night, and Karen taught me the intricacies of the 70% off aisle after Christmas. I don't know if you know about that, but you can get wrapping paper and all kinds of Christmas supplies for next year for 70% off. She also taught me on this date night that you can repackage Christmas chocolates and candies as Valentine candies. You just scratch out Christmas and put Valentine's on it. She taught me how to argue with the clerk and ask for the manager, because that's what Karens do. I'm not even making this up. She had a lot of coupons, and they didn't want to accept them, and it was a whole thing. But our very first date as a couple is much higher class than Target. We went to Pizza Hut. First date. Hard to get up the nerve to ask her out. I finally asked her out. We were 16 years old at the time, and I'm like, let's do dinner and a movie. And so we lived in a small town, and the next town over, there's the only restaurant, and it was a Pizza Hut. Pretty sure I used my book at points to pay for that meal. Those of you who grew up in the 80s and 90s know what those are. But we were really close friends before we started dating. She was probably my best friend or in my group of best friends at that time. So it was a good date. It wasn't really awkward conversation because we knew each other well. I thought it was going well, but apparently I cut my pizza with a fork. And because of that, I didn't get another date for 6 months. I found out later that that was not something that is acceptable to Karen. Also, I held my fork like a caveman. She said, I hold it like this, or I did at the time, and scooped my food into my mouth. So I ate my fork with a pizza, or ate my pizza with a fork and held my fork like a caveman. Meals matter. Almost ruined our relationship. Think about your dining room table that you have at home. And I hope you have family meals or you eat with other people, but what dramas have happened around that one simple piece of furniture? What stories have you shared with your wife or your kids over that table? Who have you fought with at that table? We've been playing board games in my family at our table. It's been rough. It's almost split our family apart this week. Who have you poked fun at your kitchen table? Have you made any important decisions sitting around that table over a meal? See, food has an ability to connect us. God could have given us any way to get our energy. We could be like plants and draw energy from the sun or the soil, but he's designed our bodies to get hungry multiple times every day. In fact, we would die if we did not eat, but food is more than fuel. It's designed for us to enjoy it. It's a new year. Many of you have enjoyed food a little too much over these past few weeks. I had to pull out my fat clothes from the closet just to come to church tonight, so that's a little awkward. But I imagine more than one person in this room, you made a New Year's resolution of some sort of dieting or some sort of eating change. Because it says at any given moment, here's a statistic, 25% of American men and 45% of women are dieting. I also read this week, Americans spend $50 billion each year on dieting. So we spend $50 billion to overcome the fact that we already spent way too much money over consuming food. Here's a statistic, and I did share this one to Facebook. American Christians spend more on dieting than world missions. That means, in other words, believers spend more trying to cure our overconsumption than trying to feed, physically or spiritually, the hungry of the world. That's pretty impactful, but that's another sermon for another night. I spent my Christmas message, if you were here 2 weeks ago, teaching from Luke 2, and I was trying to express what Christmas is all about. And I said, it's not about the shepherds or the angels or the mangers. It's about God's invasion into human history to rescue me. That in a moment, 2,000 years ago, the all-powerful, the all-knowing, the King of Kings, he stepped down from his throne of eternal glory. He invades our dark world. He comes as a baby. But we made the point that, yes, that baby grows up and he teaches and he lives and he goes to the cross and he dies. And so we're going to begin looking at some of his teachings as an adult. In Mark chapter 10, verse 45, Jesus teaches, and he uses this word that he uses often about himself. He says, the Son of Man. That's how he referred to himself, the Son of Man. It's one of his favorite names that he uses, and it's a reference back to Daniel in the Old Testament. Daniel says, the Son of Man is one who comes before God to receive authority over the nations. That would be like a king. So Son of Man means the king. And so Jesus says, the Son of Man, the king, came not to be served, but to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's about as clear of a mission statement as you can get for Jesus, that he came into the world to give his life, to pay the wages of sin for many. Luke uses a couple of examples of this Son of Man. In Luke chapter 19, verse 10, Luke says, Jesus speaking, for the Son of Man came to seek and save those who are lost. It's a pretty good purpose. It's a pretty good mission statement we get about the Son of Man. But this is the one that stood out. Those are purpose statements. Jesus also makes a method statement in Luke chapter 7. He says, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. It's kind of a weird thing to say about yourself. I came eating and drinking. See, the Jews at the time, they were looking for a king, but they wanted a king to vindicate them, a king to defeat God's enemy. A Son of Man who came with power and strength. But Jesus doesn't come with an army. He doesn't come yielding political power. It says, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. And maybe you think, of course he does. We all need food to survive. This is just Luke or Jesus trying to show us that he's human, fully God, fully human. But it's also clear in this text that Luke isn't just talking about him eating and drinking for survival. It says, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. And you say, and he's speaking to the Pharisees, here is a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. What's a glutton? Somebody who eats too much. What's a drunkard? Somebody who drinks too much. Can't help but think of a Dave Matthews song right there. Drink too much, drink too much. To be clear, Jesus wasn't a glutton. He wasn't a drunk, because Jesus never sinned, so that's not possible. But it would seem his preferred method for ministry from this text was a meal. And he did so many meals and so much eating and drinking, doing discipleship and sharing the good news around a table over grilled fish and a loaf of bread and a big pitcher of wine, that those who were haters of Jesus could accuse him of being a drunkard and a glutton. He ate and drank a lot and often. And so as we work through the Gospel of Luke, I think the way I'm going to teach it is to attempt to pull out the meals of Jesus or the time he's speaking or talking about food. Because I think food and meals is so often included in Luke's Gospel and Jesus' teaching and ministry because it represents something greater. That Jesus' excess of food is linked to his excess of grace. This is what Peter Lightheart, he's got a book called Blessed Are the Hungry. They're little communion meditations that are really nice. He says this. He says, for Jesus, feast was not just a metaphor for the kingdom. As Jesus announced the feast of the kingdom, he also brought it into reality through his own feasting. Unlike many theologians, he did not come preaching an ideology, promoting ideas, or teaching moral maxims. He came teaching about the feast of the kingdom, and he came feasting in the kingdom. Jesus did not go around merely talking about eating and drinking. He went around eating and drinking a lot. As individuals, we think, to share the gospel, we need to be amazing theologians, or we need to have all this Bible knowledge, or we can't share Jesus. As a church, many churches often think we need to have all these programs if we're going to share Jesus, or we need to have the best speaker or the most amazing worship, or give somebody a free coffee mug just for showing up the church. But the Son of Man had this incredible power and might, could have did anything he wanted, and it says he came eating and drinking. That was his preferred method for teaching, for extending the good news of grace. So we're going to look at one of those stories tonight in Luke chapter 5. Let me just catch you up a little bit to where we're at in the Gospel of Luke. We're five chapters in now. We did the birth story in the first week of John the Baptist, Elizabeth, and Zechariah. We did the birth story of Jesus 2 weeks ago when we met in here for Christmas. That's in chapter 2. Then it moves on. John the Baptist, he's preparing the way for Jesus, the calling saying the Lamb of God is coming. Jesus, or John the Baptist baptizes Jesus, and that begins Jesus's public ministry. That's the start of his public ministry. And immediately after he's baptized, it says the Spirit leads him out into the wilderness where Jesus fasts and prays for 40 days and 40 nights. And while he's fasting and praying, we're told that he is tempted by Satan. And he overcomes Satan's temptations and he moves on to Nazareth, his hometown, his little bitty poor rural town. And he begins to teach there. And people like his teaching at first, but then he really pours out some truth and they're like, oh, we don't like you anymore. They try to throw him off of a cliff. Later on, Jesus goes on and he performs many miracles. And now he's starting to call disciples to follow him. That's where we pick up in the story tonight. It says in Luke chapter 5, verse 27, it says later, after all that stuff has happened, as Jesus left the town, he saw a tax collector named Levi. Now, Levi, Matthew, same person. Gospel of Matthew, written by Levi. They're the same people. Sitting at his tax collector's booth. We've said this before, I think. Tax collectors, they weren't just low-class individuals. They were the social outcasts. They were in a position to cheat people. They skimmed money off the top. They didn't just collect taxes. They took off top of the taxes. And so basically, if you read about them, their job was sinning for a living. And worse, they were collecting taxes for the Roman government, which was the enemy of Israel. And so they were considered traitors. Traitors to the nation of Israel, which made them traitors to God. And Jesus says to this traitor, this despicable human being, he says, follow me and be my disciple. What do you think's running through Levi's mind? What has he heard about Jesus? What has he heard about the rumors of the healings? Does he wonder why Jesus would speak to somebody like him, let alone ask him to come be one of his disciples? We don't know. I imagine all kinds of thoughts and questions ran through his head. It says, so Levi, well, he got up. He left everything, and he followed him. We don't know what Levi was thinking, but whatever it is, he makes the greatest decision of his life. He sits aside all his questions, all his doubts. He sits aside his past, his present, his future, and he responds to the call to follow Jesus. Verse 29 says, later, Levi, Matthew, held a banquet in his home with Jesus as the guest of honor. Many of Levi's fellow tax collectors and other guests, I like the word other guests, also ate with them. See, Levi, he's a new follower of Jesus. He doesn't know what Christians are supposed to do. His friends aren't probably church people. They're probably raw and real, cuss a little bit or a good bit. Jesus, he probably asked questions to Jesus that nobody else is willing to ask. See, Levi follows Jesus with very little knowledge, very little training, no clue other than he loves Jesus. And he immediately moves from extortionist to a life group leader. Did you see that? He invites all his friends over to his house. We call it a life group. It's getting together and having a meal. And he's not worried about these people coming into his home and messing it up or tracking in their mud, both literally and figuratively. He invites them into his home, and then he invites in Jesus. Not everybody's called to stand up here and preach in front of a crowd or stand behind a pulpit. Thank God not everyone is called to go knock on doors and ask people if they've met Jesus. But we are all called, and we can all do this. We can all invite friends and Jesus over for a meal. One of our major focuses this year as a church, we've been talking with our leadership and planning team, is we want to focus on deep relationships. I feel like we've kind of failed in this area and we need improvement and we want to do better as a church. So I'm very excited that we kind of give this challenge to this group of leaders, and they said, okay, we're going to step up and we're going to do this. And so I just want to focus on a couple of those. Carly Leote, where are you at, Carly? She's in the back of the room, if you don't know Carly. And she's like, I got this idea. I want to start a book club, but I know a lot of people are like me, and we don't have time to meet and can't get together, and we got kids and this and that. How about we start a Facebook group? And so I said, sounds great. You put it together, you do it all. And she did. She put it together, she did it all. She came up with a list of 12 books, a book every month for the next 12 months to read. And then you go to this Facebook page and you have a discussion. Now, I saw this week, several of you have already said, I want to be a part of this, mostly females. Apparently, guys at this church do not read books because you're spending all your time reading the Bible, I'm sure. But that's a good group, and that's exciting. And she said, I'm just going to start this. And I'll just be honest with you, I saw the books. They're a little challenging, and some of them I may disagree with, and that's exactly what we want, because we want to be challenged as believers. And so I encourage you to be a part of that. And if you like that book, it just offends me, then don't read that book and pick up next month. That's fine. I want to also mention Matt. Matt, you raise your hand or wave whatever over here. Matt started, when did you start your life group that kind of connected with Refuge here?
1 year ago.
1 year ago. So 1 year ago, he said, hey, people need to get together outside of this church once a week. And so he started a life group that meets on Tuesdays at 6 o'clock, I believe, or 6:30. And they meet in homes sometimes, or they don't have a home available. They meet here, and they talk about the Bible. They do meals sometimes, not every, always do a meal. That's perfect. So always do a meal. And so they're doing what Levi did, and this group has grown, and it's flourished. And now they've started a second group. I know I saw Jeff here somewhere, right? There's Jeff. Jeff Holloman. He was a part of that group. And he said, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a part of it. Now he and his wife are starting a split-off group from that. And when does your group meet?
Well, we're taking over this Tuesday
at 6:30.
Wednesdays.
And so all of this will be on Facebook. If you're a person on our Facebook group page, you'll have that information. We'll have it on the screen in coming weeks. But that's exciting news that a group started because somebody said, yeah, I want to start. I want to invite people over to my home. I want to invite in Jesus. Now we're starting another group. I want to invite people over to my home or church or wherever, and I want to invite in Jesus. And that has happened since we've been a church. We haven't put a lot of effort into this. We just said, we want to challenge you. If you think a group needs to be started, start one. And so Scott did that several years ago. He started Samson Society, and it's still going strong on Wednesday nights at 7. They're having a group, and they get together. It's all guys, and they just talk about the rawness and the real stuff and vices and just stuff that guys deal with in life, and they have this group. And I know, Mike, I saw you somewhere earlier. You guys still meeting on Thursday morning? At like 3 a.m. or something, at 7 a.m., and they just work through the Bible together. And it's a small group because it's early in the morning, but if you want to get together, there's opportunities. There's youth things, which we're replanning to build it around a meal. Robert and I have been with men. We just get together and we go have a meal because that's what Jesus did. We don't have any agenda, any initiative other than, hey, Thursday night, let's get a bunch of guys together and let's do a meal. So that's what Levi did. That's what we can do. It's that easy. And let me add, don't just be inviting church people to this stuff. And don't only have church events. Non-Jesus followers need to come into our homes and to have meals together as often, if not more often, than we're having meals with other believers. Because we want to give them an opportunity to meet Jesus, if by no other way than your hospitality of inviting people over. Verse 30 says, but the Pharisees and their teachers of religious law complained bitterly to Jesus' disciples. Why do you eat and drink with such scum? Jesus answered them, healthy people don't need a doctor, sick people do. I've come to call not those who think they are righteous, but those who know they are sinners and need to repent. The problem for the Pharisees isn't that Jesus is at a party. The problem for the Pharisees is the guest list for this party. Pharisees had lots of big, fancy parties. They're just not down with the guest list. Over this Christmas break, wasn't sure what to watch, and so we started rewatching Downton Abbey. I know there's a few folks in here that watch it, and I've talked about before that I've just been enthralled the last couple of months with British culture and just learning all about it. This is set about 100 years ago. It's the 1910s, the 1920s. It's the Earl of Grantham and his family, his daughters and his grandmama and his wife, and they're the British aristocracy at this time, when that period of time was kind of coming to an end. And they live in this huge house. It's got to be 50,000 square feet. It's ridiculous. It takes like 25 servants to run the house. And as best I can gather, this family's job, their only job in life, is to be served by these people. And so every night, it's like being on a cruise, basically. You get served all day and you do your stuff, and then you come for dinner and you have a big banquet every night, and you put on your fancy clothes and your nice ties and special outfits, and you have your fancy white glove dinner. And then after the servants finish the meal and get taken care of all the needs of the people they're taking care of, they go downstairs and they have their own meal. Now, they would never consider eating with the lords and the ladies. That would be an embarrassment to the family to ever allow such a thing to happen. And both classes understood that. They're very far removed. Until Sybil, the youngest daughter, she marries the driver, who also happens to be a servant, and he's Irish, which is apparently just as bad. And she's almost kicked out of the family for this. They work through that, and then it's, well, what about dinner? I mean, can we have a servant come to our dinner? And Sybil, she insists. And so he comes to dinner, but he doesn't have the right clothes. He doesn't say the right things. He talks about things that are inappropriate for gentlemanly dinner conversation. So here's Jesus. He's God in the flesh, perfection incarnate. He's more than aristocrat. He's more than a duke or an earl. It says he's the King of Kings. He's the Lord of Lords. And here he comes, and he eats with and he drinks with the scum of the earth, his own enemies. Anthropologists have concluded from lots of studies I kind of dug through this week that in all cultures across the world, in all time periods, meals have represented boundary markers. Think about the people you eat with. Imagine it's a pretty select group. It's your family. It's some close friends. People who look like you, think like you, act like you. People who don't annoy you. People who don't hold their forks weird. And I want to turn briefly to the Old Testament. Prophet Isaiah, speaking to the Jewish nation, Isaiah chapter 25, he says this: "In Jerusalem, the Lord of heaven's armies will spread a wonderful feast for all the people of the world. It will be a delicious banquet with clear, well-aged wine and choice meat." That's what the prophet Isaiah said was supposed to be going on. But in the years before Jesus' birth, the invite list for this feast, this great banquet, it just kept shrinking and became incredibly short. The dietary laws had become so restrictive, well beyond what the Old Testament taught, that it was basically impossible to have a meal with a Gentile. And it goes without saying, you wouldn't have a meal with a sinner. The Pharisees believed that Israel had to be pure before the kingdom of God could be restored. And so they took the purity laws and all the things in the Old Testament, many that were meant just for the temple, and they pushed these onto all the Jews and made them do it year-round because they believed that the future of Israel and God's blessing depended on holy living and not being defiled by those they considered unholy. And so their message to Jesus' disciples was clear. These people that your rabbi is eating with do not measure up to our standards. See, the Pharisees, they could clearly see the sins of others, and they could point them out, but they couldn't see, or they wouldn't admit, their own sin. There's another meal later in Luke, and I'm going to jump to it in chapter 11. Jesus has been preaching, teaching all day, and a Pharisee is there, and he asks him to come over to his house to dine. And Pharisee invites Jesus to have a meal with him, and Jesus accepts, and he goes over to the house, but he doesn't do the ceremonial washing that you're supposed to do before the meal. It's a major faux pas. You're supposed to do that. And he sees this look of disgust on the Pharisee's face, and so Jesus says in Luke 11:39, "You Pharisees are so careful to clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you are filthy, full of greed and wickedness. Fools, Didn't God make the inside as well as the outside? So clean the inside by giving gifts to the poor, and you will be clean all over. And he repeats this a few times in similar ways. See, religious people, we build barriers. I call it spiritual aristocracy. Look how awesome I am as a Christian. I'm up here, and you're down there. And maybe you're sitting here tonight, and you're feeling pretty holy about that. Glad that's not me. I'm not one of those kind of Christians. Glad I'm not one of those Pharisees. If you're thinking that, you might want to check yourself before you wreck yourself. Have you ever, condemned a community that has high divorce rates and dysfunctional families, never lifted a finger to help out? Have you ever condemned women for having an abortion, but you've never done anything to support adoptions or unwanted children? Have you ever went out to dinner and looked down at a waitress because the service was horrible, while never even considering how her day or her life has gone and what you could do to make that a little better? Maybe you've displayed your profound knowledge of the Bible and you've used it to belittle and judge others instead of allowing the text to reveal your own sin. Or maybe you've judged the other whitewashed tombs in the church. I'm glad I'm a Christian who gets it. I get God's grace. I know how broken I am and how much I need it, those other Christians. And you've become self-righteous against the self-righteous. I was convicted in studying this text how much more I need to spend thinking about my own sins and how much less time I need to spend thinking about the sins of others. So much so that I made it my New Year's resolution. Put it on Facebook if you're friends with me. And I thought this was a pretty good resolution. I wasn't going to do one, but I was just convicted by the text. And man, I posted it, and I'm like, man, it's much better than most of the resolutions I've seen out there, because most of the resolutions are go on a diet, and man, those people have forgotten about their diet by Monday, or it's exercising, and they waste money, and they join a gym, and they never go to the gym, or it's saving more, and then they see something in their newsfeed, and they buy it, and do you see how quickly we become Pharisees? I have a lot of sympathy for the Pharisees, if you haven't noticed. Because the Pharisees, they believed deeply that Jesus, who was a Jew like them, that him eating with the unclean sinners and pagans would then become contaminated by them. And if you became unclean as a Jew, you couldn't enter the temple. You couldn't worship with your church family. You would not receive the blessings from God. If you read chapter 5 this week, and I hope you did, or I encourage you to do so if you haven't, kind of keep up pace with us on this teaching. In chapter 5, right before this meal, Jesus heals a leper. I taught on this a few years back. Leprosy wasn't just a skin condition. It was a total condition of uncleanliness. Lepers were thought to be extremely contagious, so you wouldn't dare touch a leper. Lepers had to live outside of town. You had to keep 6-foot distance from everyone if you were a leper. If a leper came in contact with another person, they were supposed to shout, "Unclean, unclean." Their disease defined their lives. But in the story, when the leper asked Jesus to heal him, Luke chapter 5, verse 13, it says, Jesus reached out and touched him. "I am willing," he said, "be healed." Jesus didn't have to touch him. He could have just spoken. He could have called down hellfire or whatever. But he touches him, saying, "Nothing can make me unclean. No matter how defiled you are, no matter what you've done in your past, no matter what's been done to you in your past, no matter if you're a tax collector, a prostitute, a sinner, a lukewarm Christian, or a Pharisee, I can make you instantly clean." Jesus works infection in reverse. When you come in contact with Jesus, it infects the way you think. It infects the way you interact with others. It infects the way you view life. He infects us with his goodness, with his grace, with his mercy, with his love, and then he sends us out to help infect others. And so when Levi and his rebel scum friends have a meal with Jesus, instead of the unclean infecting the clean, Jesus the clean infects the unclean. said I preached on that a couple of years ago, and I just was looking back at my notes. It's from the Gospel of Matthew, of course, Levi and Matthew being the same, and I asked the question to the church at that time, which many of you were here. I said, are we a church that attracts the same misfits and sinners that Jesus attracted? And I sometimes can't believe I said this, but I said, I wish our church were filled with prostitutes. I wish we were known as the church with all the gay couples in town. I wish we'd find needles in the bathrooms left behind by the addicts who attend this church. Not because we want to embrace sin as a church, but because we want to infect people with the good news and the grace of Christ. I want to talk about, this is kind of my big announcement for the night, a new ministry that we are starting at the church that feeds into this. And my wife has kind of came up with the idea for this ministry and been heading up, implementing it, and getting it off the ground. And it's called just Mentor Moms. They're focusing on positive parenting, and they're doing it with the women of Into the Jordan Ministries. And if you don't know who that ministry is, it's a ministry we support every month with $1,000. We've been connected with. We send over $1,000. We do other things to help them. And it's people who have came out of sex trafficking, women. So they're prostitutes. And if you can imagine, if you're a prostitute, several other things typically go with that. Broken homes, drug addiction, alcohol addiction, a whole litany of things. And so we're starting this ministry of going in, and here's their mission statement: teaching parents how to have positive interactions and build healthy relationships with children through instruction, hands-on teaching, and modeling. And that sounds nice, but they're doing that with prostitutes. Now, this is an intense ministry. It's a major time commitment. And so far, it's put together as an 8-month program of just going into these homes and teaching how to discipline kids, how to create boundaries, how to establish after-school routines, how to do homework with your kids, how to create a proper environment in the home, how to establish bedtime routines, how to pack a backpack, how to properly play with your kids, how to practice self-care for yourself, how to have a family meal. And there's going to be weekly check-ins with these moms and calls and texts. This is an intense new ministry for our church, and it's just being built, and it's just starting. And they said, we'll give you 5 women that you can roll this out with. And so Karen prayed about it, and she's invited 5 people. And they come either from the mental health profession to start or teachers because they're used to teaching, because we want to figure this out for the next 8 months. But we're starting it anyway with 5 people and 5 ladies at End of the Jordan. So I just want to, if you raise your hand, Susan Mosley is being a part of this. My wife is being a part of this with a group. Debbie, are you here? Barbosa is not here. I told you a lot of people still traveling. She's doing it. Andrea Holland, I know, is in Canada. She's traveling. And Tanya Lang, who works in mental health therapy. These 5 women are starting this ministry that we hope we figure out, we grow, and then we build upon in the coming years as we go along as a church. And so what you can do right now, I hope you're still praying at 8 a.m., 12 p.m., and 6 p.m. At your 12 p.m. prayer, when you're supposed to be praying for Refuge Church, pray for this ministry, pray for these women, because it's going to be tough. And we've thought about like all the potholes and all the problems that are coming. People relapse all the time. And I just see getting 3 months into it and your lady relapses and they're in prison or jail. There's going to be headaches and frustrations, and there's going to be victories. And so just be in prayer for these women that they don't get frustrated and they're able to infect people with the good news of Jesus. Jesus said, healthy people don't need a doctor. Sick people do. I've come to call not those who think they are righteous, but those who know they are sinners and need to repent. I'm asked occasionally, what does it take to be a member of this church? I've been coming for a while. What do I need to do? And it's one simple phrase. You might know it. I'm a sinner and I know it. That's it. It's all you got to say. It's taken right from this story. If you want to be a member of this church, just say, I'm a sinner and I know it. That's it. Mike's been a member since day one because he's a sinner and he knows it. It's why you might hear us refer to ourselves occasionally as misfits, because we want to acknowledge that we know we are sick and broken. We want to acknowledge that we need to see a doctor. See, Jesus, these Pharisees come at him and he doesn't argue with the Pharisees. He doesn't excuse the people's sins Oh, he's a drunk because X, Y, and Z. She's a prostitute because of X, Y, Z. He doesn't do that. He looks at the Pharisees and he says, I agree with you. These people have a lot of sin in their lives. They are sick. But I'm the doctor, and I've come to heal the sick and to make these wretches my treasure. Is there hope for sinners? Without a doubt. Levi is saved. He becomes a follower of Jesus, and he has an amazing ministry. He wrote the Gospel of Matthew. Is there hope for Pharisees? Absolutely. Check out the story of Saul turned Paul, who wrote more books of the Bible than anyone else. One of them is 1 Timothy. He's writing a letter to him, and Paul, the Pharisee, or the ex-Pharisee, says this. He says, this is a trustworthy saying, and everyone should accept it. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, and I am the worst of them all. When we accept that we are sinners, that we are the worst sinner we know, because we know all the junk and all the crap in our heads, it becomes pretty easy to invite just about anyone else to our table. And so I want to end tonight with a bit of a challenge and a time of prayer and one more worship song together as we kind of respond to the teaching. 2020, it's upon us. So it's a challenge for Refuge Church. It's pretty easy. 3 meals per month outside your normal circle. So that means not your family that you have dinner with, it hopefully most nights, not the regular people you go eat with, somebody new or somebody old that you stopped having a relationship with, Christians, non-Christians, 3 meals, that's it, per month, outside of your normal circle, in your home, at a restaurant. Coffee counts as a meal. I'll even give you that one. And if, I don't know, if you're a liberal here tonight, that's your political persuasion, I want to challenge you. Invite the most right-wing Donald Trump worshiping fascist that you know. And if you're a conservative here tonight, I want you to invite a flaming Nancy Pelosi-loving liberal to dinner. I don't know who it is for you, but just I want to take a moment and ask you just to bow your heads. I'm going to ask the band to come up. And I just want you to pray. God, who would you challenge me to eat a meal with this month? I just want you to put those people in your mind as we pray.